chapter 7. If you don't have a Bible and want to borrow one, there's some at the back table. If you don't own a Bible and you want one, you're welcome to take one of those as our gift to you. From 1941 until the end of World War II in May 1945, the Nazi regime of Germany under Hitler systematically killed millions and millions of people, millions and millions of Jews, in an effort to exterminate all Jews from Europe. Victims were transported by freight trains to specially constructed extermination camps where the majority were killed in gas chambers, though others died in mass shootings or through starvation. Approximately two-thirds of Europe's 9 million Jews were murdered in the genocide we know as the Holocaust. Between the years 1948 and 1994, racial segregation was legislated and enforced in South Africa under what was called apartheid. The white minority ruled, while the black majority had their rights curbed, their rights at lots of levels, their right to associate, rights to movement, all was taken away. They were treated as inferior and faced incredible discrimination, incredible persecution. Between 1974 and 1979, the Khmer Rouge regime, led by Pol Pot, perpetrated a mass genocide in Cambodia, killing about 25% of the population of that country. Forced relocation, torture, forced labor, malnutrition, disease, along with mass executions, killed between 1.5 and 3 million people. At least 20,000 mass graves have been discovered, called the killing fields. Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or known as ISIL or ISIS, is a brutal regime established much more recently in Iraq and in Syria in the wake of the fall of Saddam Hussein. Its objective, stated objective, is to go back to the early religious practices of Islam and bring the entire world under Islamic rule. ISIS is responsible for unleashing incredible violence today, instituting sex slavery, the suppression of women, the persecution of minorities, and the murder of many, many people and many, many Christians. The regime is also responsible for perpetrating numerous terrorist acts around the world. Beyond these, we could look at other acts of violence of a different nature, even just the economic collapse of 2007 and billion-dollar bailouts to banks and seeing bank executives get huge bonuses while people lose their homes, their retirement, their savings. These are just a handful of thumbnail sketches of human evil, violence, and wickedness perpetrated in just the last 75 years or so. Countless more stories could be told. Countless more horrific details could be unpacked. Imagine what we would discover if we were to work our way back through all of human history. To these stories, let me add one more very sobering fact, that in the last 100 years, more Christians, more followers of Jesus have been martyred because of their faith than in the 19 centuries before that. It is almost humorous to hear people talk about the idea of progress. It seems like a crazy idea. Yes, we live in a world where technologically there is progression. Technologically, we are more advanced. But humanity getting better? Humanity improving? Evidence suggests otherwise. We have, over the last number of months, been studying the book of Daniel, and this morning we come to Daniel chapter 7, a passage that will hold up before us a grotesque picture of human evil, of beastly empires, of the suffering of God's people. But it holds up for us more than just that. It holds up for us hope. It holds up for us a picture of a coming kingdom that will bring evil to its end. There are five things that I want to do with you in our time together this morning. First, I want to remind you of and explain a number of things about the book of Daniel as a whole, just remind you of our context, where we've been, where we're going, and some things about Daniel as a whole. Second, I want to take a few minutes to explore questions of genre, that is, specifically the genre of this chapter and the chapters to follow, that is, apocalyptic. Third, we'll read the text, Daniel chapter 7. Fourth, I want to walk through the text and unpack the passage, explaining what it is the author is communicating to us. And then fifth, I want to reflect with you on the message of this text for us as readers of Daniel 7 today. If you've been with us over the last number of months, you know that we have been walking through Daniel, and we have till now walked through Daniel 1 to 6, the first half of the book of Daniel. Chapters 1 to 6 contain really six stories about Daniel and about his three friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, also known as Belteshazzar, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These young men, teenagers at the time, were taken by force from their native homeland in Palestine, brought to Babylon. They were forced into a process of assimilation, given Babylonian names, educated in the language and literature and culture of the Babylonians, and put to work in the Babylonian bureaucracy. And as we walk through chapters 1 to 6 in Daniel, we witnessed a variety of things. We watched God, the God of Israel, the God of his people. We saw him moving and acting, even here in Babylon, granting favor to these young men, rescuing them, working in them and through them. We watched as these young men remained faithful to God, despite all the pressure to simply go with the flow and become Babylonian, despite the very real threat of death they faced on numerous occasions. We watched as God acted powerfully in the life of a foreign pagan king, Nebuchadnezzar, bringing him to his knees, bringing him to a place of surrender and faith, a conversion. And I hope that as we've walked through these six stories, stories that are perhaps very familiar to at least some of us, that God has encouraged you, that he has blessed you, that he has challenged you. Now we turn this morning our attention from these stories in Daniel 1 to 6 to Daniel 7. As we move into this new section, we are moving into completely different territory. Daniel 7 to 12 stands apart from Daniel 1 to 6 in really obvious ways. Whereas Daniel 1 to 6 is narratives, it tells us stories, relatively simple, straightforward accounts of the lives of these four young men and those they encountered in their time in Babylon. Stories that we tell to children, stories that many of us learned as children. Now we turn to Daniel 7 to 12, which, quite frankly, will seem very bizarre. Very weird. Visions, angels, thrones, grotesque beasts, all kinds of weird things. And we're going to be struck with questions over and over and over again. What are we supposed to do with such bizarre texts, chapters, verses, accounts? How are we to understand this material that is so radically different than what we typically encounter, certainly different than what we've encountered up to this point? What does this mean? What does it mean for us? And so in order to prepare us to begin to explore this passage this morning and those that we will face look at in the weeks ahead, I want to take a few minutes to turn to the second thing I want to look at, and that is genre, specifically the genre of apocalyptic. Now, genre is a term simply used to speak to the categorization of a particular type of literature. There are all kinds of types of literature. Not everything that you read, not everything that is written is the same as the next piece of literature, right? I mean, intuitively, whether or not you realize it or not, you all know and understand something of genres. We read different genres differently. Earlier this week, Christine gave me a note. It was really quite sweet. And she wrote, apples, bananas, tuna, milk, and ice cream with a question mark. It wasn't sweet, right? I mean, it's a grocery list. You read a grocery list differently than you'd read a love letter or a little note from your significant other in your life. So we intuitively know this. We read different forms of literature in different ways. You read a grocery list different than you read a newspaper. You read that differently than you'd read a novel or a dictionary. As we come to Daniel 7 and the chapters that follow, it is vital that we understand that we are now entering into a category of literature that is called apocalyptic. And so I want to explain to you what that is. Now, the biggest example of apocalyptic in the Bible is the book of Revelation. Literally translated, the title of the Revelation means the apocalypse is the Greek word that stands before that, translated the Revelation. And apocalypse literally means unveiling. Just a quick aside, it's never revelations. It's the revelation, the unveiling. Little pet peeve, but it's singular. The unveiling, that is, it's a term used to describe the lifting off the cover of a box or the pulling back of curtains. It opens up to us a view of reality that was otherwise not visible to us. Now, apocalyptic was a genre that flourished for a period of about 400 years, from about 200 years before the time of Christ to about 200 years after. It flourished among Jews and Christians. I already mentioned that the book of Revelation is the largest, most significant piece of apocalyptic that we have in the Bible. But there are other portions of the Bible that also are written in this genre. There are portions of Isaiah, portions of Ezekiel, Zechariah. Mark chapter 13 is often referred to by biblical scholars as the little apocalypse. We have numerous other extra-biblical forms of or pieces of apocalyptic literature as well, pieces that are not part of Scripture but from the same period of history. Now, some of the major characteristics of apocalyptic literature, let me explain some of those to you. Often they take the form of visions or dreams. That is, they differ from, say, prophetic literature in that in prophetic literature, God often speaks very directly to a prophet who relays a message. In apocalyptic, God speaks more or communicates more indirectly through a dream or vision that the recipient is told to pass on or sometimes to seal up, depending on where we're at. Language is highly, highly symbolic and sometimes cryptic. It's mysterious and not always super clear, at least initially. Often written, carefully crafted pieces of literature. It makes use of numbers symbolically. Apocalyptic, maybe this is one of the most significant things for us to grasp, is that it is metaphor rich. That is, it employs metaphors to describe and to communicate it. And metaphors teach by analogy, right? Metaphors, they throw light on difficult concepts and ideas by relating them to something from our common experiences. A number of years ago, most of you know that my wife has celiac disease, and so she was diagnosed before we got married. And so gluten-free food has come a long ways over the last 20 or so years. It's improved. But gluten-free bread back when, you know, let's say 15 years ago, it was pretty gross, really. I mean, God bless those who needed it and liked it. It was better than getting sick eating normal bread, I suppose. But it was really pretty nasty. And I always described it as, it was like biting into a piece of styrofoam and then having it fall apart in your mouth like sand. I don't know if any of you can identify. But in fact, kind of an amusing story, probably about 13 or 14 years ago here, someone said, hey, we should just use rice bread for communion. That way Crystal can participate. We don't have to, you know, just... and anyone else who needs it. And so we didn't tell anyone. It was just cut up, and we passed trays at that time, and people took cubes. And you just kind of heard this as the trays went back and people took that. It was like, you know, everyone wanted more grape juice because it just kind of just falls apart. It's sandy and gross. Now, that's metaphor. You know, you could say, well, have you ever bitten in a styrofoam and had a mouthful of sand? You know, I could say yes. One could do that, but... you understand that. You use metaphor to communicate something, and you, just by me describing it that way, you get it. Apocalyptic uses metaphor. It uses images to communicate other truths. And so we need to understand that as such, it communicates truth, and it communicates accurately, but not precisely. This is not, metaphor is not how you describe something if you're trying to describe something scientifically. For example, It is communicating truth accurately, but not precisely. Now, here's what I think is maybe most important for us to grasp. Two things. First, apocalyptic seeks to set the present in light of the unseen realities of the future, and it seeks to set the present in light of the invisible realities of the present. Okay, so set the present in light of the unseen realities of the future, and to set the present in light of the invisible realities of the present. Daryl Johnson writes this: the fundamental conviction of the apocalyptic literature is that things are not as they seem. There is more to reality than meets the unaided eyes or ears. There is more to the present historical moment than we can deduce. An apocalyptic writing seeks to unveil that unseen reality of the present, to pull back the curtain on the present so that we see what is really going on. So with that foundation laid, let's turn to our biblical text. I'm going to read 28 verses. It's a longer text, but just read and listen. Think through as you hear these images. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream, and visions passed through his mind as he was lying in bed. He wrote down the substance of his dream. Daniel said, "In my vision at night I looked, and there before me were the four winds of heaven churning up the great sea. Four great beasts, each different from the others, came up out of the sea. The first was like a lion, and it had the wings of an eagle. I watched until its wings were torn off, and it was lifted from the ground so that it stood on 2 feet like a human being, and the mind of a human was given to it. And there before me was a second beast, which looked like a bear. It was raised up on one of its sides, and it had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth. It was told, 'Get up and eat your fill of flesh.' After that I looked, and there before me was another beast, one that looked like a leopard, and on its back it had 4 wings like those of a bird. This beast had 4 heads, and it was given authority to rule. After that, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was a 4th beast, terrifying and frightening and very powerful. It had large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. It was different from all the former beasts, and it had 10 horns. While I was thinking about the horns, there before me was another horn, a little one, which came up among them, and 3 of the 1st horns were uprooted before it. This horn had eyes like the eyes of a human being and a mouth that spoke boastfully. As I looked, thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was as white as snow. The hair of his head was white like wool. His throne was flaming with fire, and its wheels were all ablaze. A river of fire was flowing, coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands attended him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated, and the books were opened. Then I continued to watch because of the boastful words the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body destroyed and thrown into the blazing fire. The other beasts had been stripped of their authority, but were allowed to live for a period of time. In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All nations and peoples of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. I, Daniel, was troubled in spirit, and the visions that passed through my mind disturbed me. I approached one of those standing there and asked him the meaning of all this. So he told me and gave me the interpretation of these things. The 4 great beasts are 4 kings that will rise from the earth, but the holy people of the Most High will receive the kingdom and will possess it forever. Yes, forever and ever. Then I wanted to know the meaning of the 4th beast, which was different from all the others and most terrifying, with its iron teeth and bronze claws, the beast that crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. I also wanted to know about the 10 horns on its head and about the other horn that came up, before which 3 of them fell, the horn that looked more imposing than the others and that had eyes and a mouth that spoke boastfully. As I watched, this horn was waging war against the holy people and defeating them until the Ancient of Days came and pronounced judgment in favor of the holy people of the Most High. And the time came when they possessed the kingdom. He gave me this explanation. The fourth beast is a fourth kingdom that will appear on earth. It will be different from all the other kingdoms and will devour the whole earth, trampling it down and crushing it. The ten horns are ten kings who will come from this kingdom. After them, another king will arise, different from the earlier ones. He will subdue three kings. He will speak against the Most High and oppress his holy people and try to change the set times and the laws. The holy people will be delivered into his hands for a time, times, and half a time. But the court will sit and his power will be taken away and completely destroyed forever. Then the sovereignty, power, and greatness of all the kingdoms under heaven will be handed over to the holy people of the Most High. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all rulers will worship and obey him. This is the end of the matter. I, Daniel, was deeply troubled by my thoughts, and my face turned pale, but I kept the matter to myself. Chapter 7 scrolls back in time to King Belshazzar. You remember him from chapter 5, the writing on the wall story. That was, in fact, this vision that Daniel received that he recounts here, this dream, actually happened before the events of chapter 5. Chapter 5 happens on the last night that Belshazzar was king. He was killed that night and Persia took over. So this happened in the first year of Belshazzar's reign. Daniel is laying in bed and God gives him a dream, a vision passed through his mind, and he writes down what he saw. Now Daniel's vision begins by locating him on the shore of the sea, if you will. Winds are blowing from the four winds of heaven, that is from all four points of the compass. Imagine the chaos of the water, the huge waves breaking, raging, turbulence, chaos. On a psychological level, this picture is daunting. Just foreboding danger. But beyond that psychological level of imagining the waves whipping around, raging, there is a literary background to take into account. In the ancient Near East, by the time of Daniel, the sea was a potent symbol of chaos, a symbol of the destructive powers of evil. We see that played out in a variety of ancient Near Eastern stories and mythologies. And we even see that that theme portrayed in Scripture at different points. Yahweh's struggle against and victory is over evil is sometimes recounted as a fight against the sea or the monsters of the sea. So right here at the beginning of Daniel's vision, as it opens, horror is anticipated. Horror and anticipation of evil is kindled within our hearts as readers. Daniel stands on the shore of the sea. Daniel, standing there, seeing these waves rage, he looks and he sees a succession of four great beasts coming out of the sea. Each bizarre, each really a mutant creature, a perversion of God's good created order. As we see these beasts, one thing we can conclude is that this is not the way things were supposed to be. These are not the kinds of creatures, each according to its own kind. These are perversions. These are mutations. This is grotesque. Beings, beasts that we see coming out of the sea. Now there is a connection that is made, and we won't make a lot of it, but a connection between these four beasts coming out of the sea and Nebuchadnezzar's dream back in chapter 2. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar had his dream. He didn't tell his wise men what it was. He wanted them to tell him the content of his dream and interpret it. The dream of the huge statue, the head of gold and a chest and arms of silver, belly and thighs of bronze, and then legs of iron and feet of iron and clay. That was about four empires. And I explained at that point that some people do all kinds of work and try and figure out, okay, which empire is which. We know that the head of gold was Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar. The text tells us that. But beyond that, people will argue different things. For a Greek understanding says, well, the second kingdom is the Median kingdom, the third is the Persian kingdom, and the fourth is the Greek empire which came. Others will argue for Rome and say, well, Media Persia was one empire. I want to contend that neither of those really works. There are weaknesses there. And so we're not going to go down that path here trying to make that association. Certainly we can conclude that like the head of gold as Babylon, here the lion that had wings of an eagle that comes out is Babylon, is Nebuchadnezzar again. Even some of what it says towards the end, that this beast, wings were ripped off, stood on 2 feet like a human being and had the mind of a human given to it, is reminiscent of the Nebuchadnezzar story where Nebuchadnezzar became like a beast for a season and then was restored and given his human mind back and came actually to faith in Yahweh. But beyond that, we can't say much. I want to contend, as I say that, that the author's goal here, God's goal in giving Daniel this vision and giving this text to us, is not to provide us with a play-by-play of history in advance, as if that would in any way be practical or helpful to God's people. God is not giving this so that Daniel can map this out and so that God's people can read and go, okay, this king comes and then this king comes and then this is going to happen, and try and figure out the details of history before it unfolds. There is simply no point. And I think that the vision prohibits any definite historical identification of the final three kingdoms. The fourfold pattern, the four beasts, simply inform us of this reality that is true in our world, that evil kingdom will follow evil kingdom will follow evil kingdom until the end. The reality is here, even as we read this, anyone who would conclude that the fourth beast somehow is Rome or Greece, well, what happens here? Because we read this vision and judgment comes and the end comes, and living today, it hasn't come yet, so how do we understand it? So it's simply, it's not giving us precise history in that way. It's simply saying evil empire will follow evil empire until the end, which brings us to verse 9 and following. Here the scene of Daniel's vision shifts abruptly. From standing on the shore of the sea where these waves rage, where these four grotesque beasts come out of the sea, now suddenly Daniel finds himself in a courtroom. He sees thrones, and Daniel sees the first principal character of this part of the vision before him, this divine character, this Ancient of Days who takes a seat on the throne, this kingly figure, a divine figure, described in human-like terms, which is interesting because we know from Genesis that humankind, men and women, were created in the image of God, and here we see the Ancient of Days portrayed in human-like terms. This is none other than God, Yahweh. White hair, white clothing, and fire around his throne. His throne was flaming with fire. Its wheels were all ablaze, and fire is flowing from it. What are we to make of those metaphors, that language to describe God? Is God really, is he an old grandpa with white hair? Is that the point? The point is simply, what does white hair symbolize? It symbolizes the wisdom of God. The white robe, the holiness, the purity, the righteousness of God, and fire flowing from his throne is a picture of God's judgment. These images all speak to who God is and what God is about. The court is seated, books are opened, and judgment falls. We read here, Daniel watches, I continue to watch in verse 11. Then I continue to watch because of the boastful words the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body destroyed and thrown into the blazing fire. Daniel sees God's holy judgment fall on the fourth beast, slain and destroyed. And note, just again, chronologically, if we're trying to figure out history in advance, right after that, the other beasts had been stripped of their authority but were allowed to live for a period of time. That would be a problem if we were talking strictly chronology. Daniel looks again and he sees a second figure, a second divine-like figure, one like a son of man riding on a cloud, a cloud chariot, if you will. The imagery of riding on the clouds was used elsewhere to speak of God. Let me just give you two references. In Psalm 104, verse 3 and 4, we read this, speaking of God, Yahweh. He makes the clouds his chariot and rides on the wings of the wind. He makes the winds his messengers, flames of fire his servants. Isaiah 19:1, see, the Lord rides on a swift cloud and is coming to Egypt. This figure, this second figure that Daniel looks and sees, this one who is his like a son of man, that is, he's a human-like character, is riding on a cloud, and that is a sign to us that this is a divine figure. This is one who is like a human, but is doing what only God does, riding in a cloud chariot, if you will. And the Ancient of Days gives him authority, glory, and sovereign power. Clearly, he is a kingly figure. And his dominion is said to be an everlasting dominion. His kingdom will never be destroyed. Of course, this imagery, this one like the Son of Man riding on the clouds, is imagery that points us ahead to a messianic king, one who is man and God. God in the flesh, Jesus Christ. Very interestingly, Jesus refers to himself more often than any other way as the Son of Man. Language that comes from Daniel, comes from this language here. Jesus uses this, and it's weird language there, but what's it getting at? He's one like the Son of Man. He is this divine messianic cloud rider coming to receive the kingdom, coming to establish the kingdom. At this point in Daniel 7, Daniel is troubled. He's shaken by what he has seen. So he approaches an angel, one standing there, and asks for an explanation of what he has seen, some help to understand it. In the remainder of the chapter, as we read through that, he asks about some specific details, and we learn some more details of Daniel's dream, and we hear the explanation of the angel. But we are likely still left scratching our heads with a lot of questions about some of those details. What are we to make of the particulars of this vision? Who is the fourth beast? What's up with the 10 horns? And this one other horn that comes out and takes 3 of the other horns out. How do we map all of this out? And to what end? Remember, apocalyptic is metaphor rich. It teaches by analogy. It throws light on difficult concepts by relating them to things that we know from common experiences. And as such, remember that the images do not communicate precisely, though they communicate accurately. The goal of the author of Daniel 7, the goal of the Lord in giving us this, is not to give us a detailed play-by-play of history in advance. It's not about the specific details. It is about the grander picture. According to this vision, after the fourth beast comes the final judgment, which remains yet in the future today. And as I noted, even after the judgment of the fourth beast in this vision, the first 3 beasts still live. So clearly this cannot be pure chronological history. The goal is not to communicate those kinds of details to us. It is about the larger drama of history. It is about the bigger picture of what is going on in this world. We live in a world where things are not the way they're supposed to be, where there are these grotesque mutant beasts, where human evil and evil empire after evil empire, evil kingdom after evil kingdom rises and falls, followed by another. And although oppressive human power seems to us unconquerable, particularly to the vanquished, to human power, we need to understand, is temporal. One evil power succeeds another in another cycle of oppression, but will one day be broken by divine intervention. One day the Ancient of Days will take his place on a throne. One day one like a Son of Man will come, and did come in the person of Jesus, and will come again. And God will judge human evil. God will bring to an end all that is ruining his creation, all that is as it should not be. And God's people will, in that day, be delivered from suffering, will be delivered from oppression, will be delivered from evil, and will inherit a kingdom, a glorious kingdom that will be eternal. So what is it? What is it that you and I are to take away from this passage? Eugene Peterson says this: we don't need more information. We need the information we have to go deeper. Remember, I said apocalyptic is about lifting the lid off a box. It is about pulling back the curtains. It is about helping us see the present in light of the unseen realities of the future. And it's about helping us see the present in light of the invisible realities of the present. It is an unveiling. It is helping us to see what is really real. To be sure, there are a variety of truth claims, propositions that one can take away from this passage. But if we simply mine it for information, for historical details, we will miss what lies at its heart. Daniel's dream, This vision that God gives him is an unveiling, a lifting off of the cover of a box, the pulling back of the curtains. Contrary to what may seem to be the case, God, the Ancient of Days, is in control. Human evil will be brought to an end. Dominant, horrific, grotesque empires who commit all kinds of atrocities will be brought to their knees, and the people of God will receive an eternal kingdom. This dream, this unveiling, is given to us as God's people to provide comfort, to provide encouragement. It is a call to remain faithful to God even as we suffer, rather than falling in with evil and experiencing God's judgment. And for those of us who have repented and put our trust in Jesus, this passage provides a shot of adrenaline when we are overwhelmed, when we are filled with fear, when we suffer, as we look around and are tempted to be overwhelmed by all the evil we see. Brothers and sisters, the reality is, and this is a message that the church, particularly in the West, needs to hear, is that we, as God's people, ought to expect opposition. We ought to expect trouble. We ought to expect suffering. Look in our text. As I watched, this horn was waging war against the holy people and defeating them. And defeating them until the Ancient of Days came and pronounced judgment in favor of the holy people of the Most High. It is incredibly naive and wrongheaded for us as God's people to ever conclude, I've given my life to Jesus, I love Jesus, I'm living a life of obedience, so God's going to give me the life that I want. It's just not in Scripture, brothers and sisters. God blesses us often with amazing gifts. Every day, every good thing in your life is a gift from God. But we ought not to expect these things. And we ought not to be surprised and devastated when suffering comes our way, when we face opposition, when we face even the threat of death. Rather, we are to step back and see the curtains pulled back and see the larger drama that is going on, that God is the Ancient of Days, that He sits on the throne, that one like a Son of Man, that Jesus Christ has come on the clouds, that He has intervened in history, that the judgment of those beastly empires, the judgment of human evil is sure. It has happened at the cross, and one day Christ will come back and that will be brought to full consummation. And we as God's people will dwell in His glorious eternal kingdom forever. For those who may be here who don't know Jesus, who've never put their faith in Him, the Bible is clear that there are only two categories of people. That there are those who have repented and put their faith in Jesus, and there are those who have not. And every one of us is born. We come into life as rebels, fighting God, resisting God, choosing to go our own way. And unless we come to Christ in repentance and faith, we remain God's enemies. We remain on the side of beastly empires. We can look at those stories, those brief accounts that I listed off at the beginning of my message and say, well, I'm not like Hitler. I'm not like Pol Pot. I'm not like these people. The reality is that apart from Christ, every one of us is on the side of beastly empires. We are rebels. We are wicked. We deserve and stand under God's judgment. The inclinations of our hearts are evil. And our only hope is Jesus. Daniel's vision speaks of God's judgment upon evil, upon God's judgment upon these grotesque beasts. And the gospel gloriously declares that this cloud rider, this Jesus, this one like a Son of Man, came. He came and He took our place. He came and he was burnt by the flames of God's judgment, the flames flowing from his throne. He took our place. He stood in the line of fire and he suffered God's judgment for us so that we might become his kingdom people. And so if you have never put your faith in Jesus, Jesus is your only hope, and he is willing and able to save you. He is willing and able to make you new. He is willing and able to make you holy. He is willing and able to make you his. I want each of you to engage your imaginations. If it's most helpful, feel free to close your eyes. As I've been reading in the news and hearing stories about refugees, I have imagined, what would it be like? For me, I've imagined our own home, 112 Kirkwood Way. What would it be like if one day armies came rolling down our street and we just had to run? Run for our lives, leave everything behind. Everything that we so often pursue and invest in, just run for our very lives. Go to a far-off country where we know no one, where we can't even speak the language. Our pockets are empty. We have nothing. Daniel 7 tells us that in that set of circumstances, we have reason for hope. That in that set of circumstances, we have reason for confidence. That we can live boldly because there is a larger drama that is unfolding, that the Ancient of Days sits on the throne that is at the center of all things. That Jesus is enough. That Jesus is enough. This may seem somewhat theoretical to us this morning. We live in Canada. We live in a place that doesn't look beastly in obvious ways. What we see in Daniel and what we is what we see in many parts of the world today in ways that are far easier to see. But remember what apocalyptic does. It helps us see the present in light of the unseen realities of the future. And it helps us see the present in light of the invisible realities of the present. Even now, even here in Canada, there is a spiritual battle raging. There is an enemy who wants to destroy, kill, steal. He wants to take us out. He wants to keep others in darkness, blind, and under God's judgment. There is more going on than meets the eye. There is a spiritual battle raging. And in the midst of that, we have this picture of God Almighty in his redemptive work, the certainty of his judgment and the establishment of his kingdom. And that gives us confidence. It is that shot of adrenaline in the arm so that we can live faithfully, boldly, courageously for him. That we can say, Jesus is enough. If I lose everything else, if I lose my loved ones, if I lose my family, if I lose my job, if I lose all these blessings that I enjoy, these things that are good things in our lives, I can lose it all. Jesus is enough. We're going to celebrate communion. And I want to invite you, I'm going to just explain a few things so that everyone's clear on how we'll do this. Communion is coming to the table of God's people. And so for you, if you have repented and believe, you put your faith